You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this evening, Garrett Kruger. Garrett, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you for having me.
So, Garrett, you are a patron of the SGU, which we greatly appreciate, but you also do a podcast of your own, I Know Dino. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's all about dinosaurs. My wife and I started it about 5 years ago now. I can't believe it's been that long, but we had a dinosaur-themed wedding, and then I was looking for a dinosaur podcast, and
Whoa. It wasn't
a weekly one.
Needle scratch, what?
He said dinosaur-themed wedding, Jay.
What happens at a dinosaur-themed wedding?
So we had, I mean, it had to be still semi-classy, so we weren't in, like, dinosaur costumes or anything. We were still in regular attire, but we did have, like, a dinosaur-themed cake. And like with little wedding toppers of, it had her favorite dinosaur.
Do you have an ice sculpture?
Dinosaur on top. Do we have a what?
Did you have an ice sculpture?
Sure.
We didn't.
All right. So
we got married in California.
Garrett, what is your favorite dinosaur?
It's Ankylosaurus. It's that cranky one.
Yeah. Second favorite. Yeah. What's your wife's favorite?
Oh, gosh.
Brontosaurus.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, she must have had a tumultuous last 10 years with brontosaurus going away and then coming back. I mean, whoa.
Yeah. So she switched to Apatosaurus when she learned that it wasn't a thing anymore, and then now she switched back to Brontosaurus because we consider it valid.
So she accepted the change at the time and then was happy to see it go back. That was very, very understanding of her.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
My daughter's favorite dinosaur is Parasaurolophus, which she could say at the age of 4, and Jay still can't say.
You're not goading me into making a fool of myself again.
It's one of my all-time favorite moments.
I can't say it. I've actually tried to say it when I'm alone. I can't say it. I said it once correctly, and Kara, like, freaked out.
It was exciting. It was a good moment. My favorite dinosaur is Styracosaurus because it's metal. It's, like, the most metal dinosaur, for sure.
Really? My favorite dinosaur is the Megasaurus.
Oh, no.
Jay, I hope you vetted this guy, Jay, because I don't want to have to kill another guest bro.
Not again.
So, Gary, in your free time, I take it you still do dinosaur stuff, right?
Yeah. So we were actually in Australia shortly before you guys.
Ooh.
There was a paleontology conference that moves all over the world, and it was in Australia last year. And then we did a road trip through the outback and everything, seeing all these dinosaur sites. It was great.
Oh, very awesome. Cool. Did you go see, it used to be Ayers Rock, and they call it Uluru now?
We didn't. We didn't go quite that far west. We stuck to, like, the less deep outback, I guess.
Yeah. That's all the way. You know, that's about as deep as you can go.
Yeah.
Well, Garrett, you're going to be telling us about a new dinosaur a little bit later in the show, which I read the report on. It's very interesting. But before we get to the news items, guys, you hear about Belle Gibson. You guys know who Belle Gibson is?
Oh, yeah. This is really good news for people who care about the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was the person who said she had brain cancer, then she cured her brain cancer with proper eating and diet and yoga. And it turns out that her entire saga was a complete lie. And she got epically busted.
Like, she didn't even have cancer?
Never had cancer.
No.
Yeah.
Here's my shocked face. Yeah.
So now the Australian government is suing her, or has sued her.
They fined her. The government doesn't sue you. They fine you, right?
Yeah, they fined her. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's fined $410,000 in 2017. And she hasn't paid yet. $410,000, which is now up to more than $500,000 with, you know, interest and fees and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, she said she couldn't pay it, and then they found out, like, you know, then they do a little research and, like, oh, you spent $30,000 on clothes this year and you can't pay us. Yeah.
13. It was 13, not 30.
Whatever.
But she should still have, she made about $500,000 on sales of her app and book, and that a lot of that money should still be around somewhere.
Garnish.
I love
it,
the
baby.
Fact that the Australian Associated Press, when they wrote about this story, they said, they opened up Fraudster Bell Gibson. So that's how they know. That's how they refer to her. Fraudster Bell Gibson.
Nice.
That is awesome.
A well-earned title.
Yeah.
Yep.
It just cut now, right to the chase.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see this happen in the United States, right? Like that's what struck me so hard when I read this article about her. This doesn't happen. It doesn't happen enough. I mean, we should be prosecuting and fining everybody that commits fraud like this. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right? Goop is a great example. Like, you know, Netflix is embracing her, and instead we should be fining the hell out of that company.
Goop, not Netflix, by the way.
Yeah.
If you claim it's magic, that's okay. But if you out and out lie, that somehow that's not okay. I agree.
Yep.
All right. Well, the first news item is a bit alarming, Jay. It's a new virus on the loose in China. Tell us about it.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
Yeah, I just assembled a bunch of facts. I thought this would help everyone kind of get up to speed on what's going on. So today is the 22nd of January. So these are the facts as of right now. So when the show comes out, things probably will have progressed.
Yeah, this is a fast-moving story. I mean, I'm reading tons of crap today. So probably a lot more info is going to be available by the time you listen to the show.
But in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are able now to study this virus because they have specimens from multiple people who have traveled to Wuhan, China, or have had close contact with quote unquote someone under investigation, because, you know, they take any kind of report of illness that's in this category, they take it extraordinarily serious, right? They track every single person and they figure out exactly what's going on with them. As of right now, 17 people have died in China with more than 547 infected with Wuhan coronavirus. Worldwide cases are reported now at 555. The virus is showing up around the world, and with the first case in the U.S. confirmed Tuesday, January 21st, so that was yesterday as we record this. A man in his 30s who lives in Washington State, where he is now hospitalized. The man recently returned from Wuhan. The latest strain of the virus can spread from person to person, according to the Chinese government. Instead of, you know, the earlier versions, you had to, you know, touch an infected animal or, you know, have it be transmitted directly from an animal. But person to person transmission is quite different. And now that is active. That's happening. So on Thursday, so that's tomorrow to us, but, you know, could be days ago when you listen to this, the World Health Organization will decide if Wuhan virus is actually considered a public health emergency of international concern. And this is a big deal. They haven't decided to do that yet because they agreed that they all need more information to make this determination. And I'm thinking by the time you hear this that they will have agreed to make this, you know, to click it up to public health emergency of international concern, because it is, you know, traveling around the world as we speak. So in an effort to keep this virus from spreading, all public transportation in Wuhan will be shut down starting on the 23rd.
Yep.
Yep. And this includes airports and trains. And they're very much not allowing people to leave. So I guess they're allowing people to come in if you live there or if you're, you know, coming to help. But they don't want anybody going anywhere. The CDC has the only laboratory in the U.S. that can test for the latest strain of the virus.
Wow.
Thank God we have that. Yeah, we're lucky that we have the technology to test the latest strain. And if you happen to play a game called Plague Inc., once your virus infects over 500 people, the world starts to take notice. And I know that, like, you know, I'm dead serious when I say that, because that's a fact of that game, because I love that game. But there is something important around the number of 500 people. When you get to that number of people, it does mean something, and the people who wrote the game were aware of that. The game is really cool, by the way. You should play it. The International Olympic Committee confirmed the Olympic boxing qualifying tournament for Tokyo 2020 has been straight up canceled because of the outbreak.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, and this is what reminded me of the game, when things like that start to happen, that's serious, right? In the game, because the game mirrors reality. So, like, you know, when big things like Olympic committees are confirming that something that was dated to happen is just flat out canceled until further notice. You know, so there is something going on. It's definitely a serious virus. These viruses can typically get handled, right? We've handled viruses like this before, but this is the exact kind of virus that can do epic damage.
So coronaviruses are like SARS and MERS, right? Those are the two closest species, I guess you could say, to this.
Yeah,
they were Yeah, like SARS was a coronavirus. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and MERS is as well. I think those are the only two. I mean, coronaviruses exist. I think they were first sampled in like human, you know, human noses. Like they weren't actually making people sick. But the two that we know that make people sick are SARS and MERS. Those are the only two related infections, right?
Those weren't nearly as deadly, though, were they?
I don't know how. I mean, they were pretty bad. They were really scary, SARS and MERS, but I'm not sure. There were definitely...
SARS was pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
How deadly is this one? What's the percentage? Did I miss it? What's
17 you heard people so far.
Huh?
Out of 555 people infected, 17 dead.
So far, right. But obviously so far, yeah. We've only known about it for like days at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it hasn't.
A lot of those might be recent.
But already scientists have figured out where it came from, which I just read, you know, hours ago, a newly published report. Did you see this?
And they quarantined it.
They're pretty sure that that this particular strain of the coronavirus was a combination of two other strains. One coronavirus found in bats and an unknown strain. So they recombined, forming a new viral strain with the ability to infect people more easily. And
I thought they traced it to snakes.
Yes, but the pathway to people went through snakes. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's two strains: a bat derived strain, some other strain. They came together in snakes for some reason, and then from snakes to people. So clearly there's cross-species transmission. That also means, if we've mentioned on the show with regard to other infections, there are non-human reservoirs of coronavirus, which means we're never going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
It's always going to be out there in the wild.
And just so you know, actually, Garrett, to answer your question, it looks like at least so far, SARS and MERS were potentially more fatal. Of course, we don't have any – we have no idea how – the Wuhan coronavirus is going to turn out. But SARS had a 9.6% fatality rate. So it was over 8,000 cases and 774 deaths across 37 countries. MERS had fewer cases. It was about 2,000 cases, but 36% of those people died.
Wow. Yeah, viral pneumonia is no joke. Because with pneumonia, you know, you can't breathe, which is one of those important things for staying alive. Mm-hmm. And it's a virus. Like it's not like a bacteria where you could just hit them with broad spectrum, heavy hitting antibiotics. A lot of viruses, you know, we have antivirals, but you know, they may not be that effective at all. And so often you do supportive care and let the infection run its course. But if the course is you can't breathe, yeah, you die.
Yeah, and that's how this started, right? Is there were a bunch of people with pneumonia in the hospital in like mid-December into January. And they were like, where is this pneumonia coming from? We can't figure it out. And finally, they were like, oh, hi, you've all got the same coronavirus.
Yeah.
So at this point, though, the World Health Organization doesn't want people to be, you know, incredibly worried. Like, they just want everyone to do the right thing, you know, be vigilant, wash your hands. You know, we're in cold season in this part of the world. You know, cold and flu season, you know, just be clean, you know, keep an eye on each other. If you're traveling, especially if you're traveling, I mean, man, you've to bring alcohol for your hands, you know, just be very cautious about germs.
And if you have pneumonia symptoms, seek treatment.
Yes. And China actually ordered everyone to wear face masks. Yeah. We talked about that recently on the show. Do they actually work? Surprisingly, they help a little if you wear them consistently and properly.
Mm-hmm. But since this is a virus, is that probably less the case?
Because the particles are small?
No, because the viral particles are transferred in water, aerosolized water droplets.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that they themselves are small. It's the droplets of water that can still get picked up by the mask. But it's not perfect. It's not proof. And most people, you know, don't do it consistently and properly enough to make a huge difference. But if you do, if you are vigilant, it could be part of an overall strategy to avoid contamination, both spreading it yourself and contracting it yourself.
Well, especially in a place where there is a high viral load and where the incidence rate is much higher, like in Wuhan province, where we know people are getting very, very sick. The fear is that people freak out when they find out that there's one case in Washington. Oh my God, you know, that guy's in the hospital, he's getting treatment, Yeah. He didn't infect a bunch of people on the way. You know, like, don't worry.
Right. Not exactly.
Well, we don't
people
know
did this
that.
With Ebola first.
He took a plane here. And
he
we
did
don't
take
know.
A plane here.
You don't know that he didn't infect anybody else.
Something. I didn't say he didn't infect everybody else, anybody else. But there is always this real fear, right, that yeah. when one person is infected. People get really irrational, I think, around these things. And the truth of the matter is that the CDC, the World Health Organization, the epidemiologist, I'm assuming, working in Washington, who have this guy quarantined and under treatment, are also doing their due diligence to ensure that nobody else gets infected. So they know what yeah. flight he was on. They're working on it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole idea, that when you have an outbreak like this, you jump on it early. You jump on
lock
it
aggressively.
Down fast. Yep. Yeah. And you know, appropriate level of concern at this point and precautions will keep it from becoming a bigger problem. But yeah, this is not like panic mode or anything.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is just normal precaution mode for an outbreak of a new strain of a virus that is concerning. It has, you know, there is a death rate associated with it.
It's a high death rate. Luckily though, this virus does seem to have similar traits to SARS and MERS, which we've now had the opportunity and that's the royal we, because I had nothing to do with it, but to study, you know, to study really well. So understanding not just the physiology, but the pathology, but the epidemiology of those viral outbreaks, I'm sure really informing the efforts that are being taken right now, which is good.
And the city's under quarantine, 11 million people, Wuhan.
Wow. Yeah.
Ugh. You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, we'll probably give updates, and yeah, by the time you hear this, there'll be more information than what we're giving.
Hopefully, better information. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyone here played the game Pandemic?
Oh yeah,
board game. Oh yeah. So Mumbai is like the hot spot mainly where usually the outbreak occurs, and obviously it's one of the most populous places on the planet.
Yeah, and Wuhan is like at the nexus of a lot of large cities in China. It's like in the worst possible place in terms of people moving around and spreading it.
Well, and you get this really, I mean, probably same in Mumbai, but you get this interesting interplay. Whereas when you look at many countries, when you go into urban areas where everybody's living on top of each other, you also don't see a lot of rural activity. But in China, it's an interesting kind of coming together of farming and wet markets and having access to live animals in very, very densely populated areas. And so I think that's, you know, just kind of a recipe for these kinds of things to explode sometimes.
All right, Bob, I understand there's some interesting things happening next door. And by next door, I mean 4 light years away.
That's not that far.
Wait, so
that's pretty far.
I mean, so the takeaway from this previous news item, we're all going to die, right? That's the takeaway I'm taking away from this?
Good. Are got you just it, tuning in now, Bob?
Isn't that the subject of most of the news items we speak?
Yes. One of these days, yes, Bob, you will die. We will all die.
So, yeah, our neighbor, the Centauri star system, has been in the news lately again. It's cool and a bit annoying. There's good evidence that a super Earth exoplanet has been discovered there. And apparently, Alpha Centauri is officially no longer Alpha Centauri, and one sent me a memo on this. But I'll get to that later. So first, I want to go over Alpha Centauri system itself. I think we need to be more familiar with this system. It's the closest stars and planets to us, to the sun. There are next door neighbors. So I think people should have a better understanding of that system than other ones, I think, because it's like, right, you know, hi guys, you could wave to them. So Alpha Centauri is
they'll see it 4 years later, but yes, you can.
Yeah, but only 4 years. So Alpha Centauri is the third brightest star in the heavens after Sirius Black. I mean after the stars Sirius and Canopus. It looks like a single star out there, but it's a triple star system. So you've got stars A and B. So they're in kind of a tight binary. They're similar to our sun. I think they're a K and an M class. So they're similar. One's a little bit bigger and brighter. One's a little bit smaller and dimmer. So together, they kind of add up to like twice our sun in terms of mass and luminosity. And that binary is 4.37 light years away. Very, very close. The star C is called Proxima Centauri, one of those two. It's a small, cool red dwarf. It orbits the other two stars every 500,000 years. So it is like a trinary star system. And as its name indicates, it's the closest star to our sun, only 4.24 light years away. Really, really close. No other star. It's going to be closer probably for our lifetimes, and maybe times a billion too. So if you want to think about Proxima Centauri in terms of numbers, it's tiny. This is 15% of the sun's radial size. It's 12% of the sun's mass. It's 0.17% of the sun's total luminosity. And in the visual spectrum, in the visible light, it's only 0.005% of the sun's visual luminosity. That's because a lot of its light, or most of it's in the infrared. So yeah, this is a really small, if really dim star, but it's still really cool. I'm sure a lot of you probably remember that back in 2016, they found an exoplanet around Proxima Centauri that orbits every 11 days. And this is called Proxima B. And it's not only about probably 30% more massive than Earth, which isn't much. I mean, it's a super Earth. It's in the habitable zone, meaning that liquid water could potentially exist on its surface. But if you look at the details, that's probably not likely. The sun is only at 5% of the Earth's sun distance. So we're talking 5% of 93 million miles. So what, 4.8 million
close.
Miles? Super close. So if it had
it
any atmosphere, yeah, it's tidally locked. So one side's locked in. So you got one side that's going to be really hot. The other side's going to be really, really chill. But you could have kind of a band around it in between those two zones that are kind of like almost kind of nice, maybe. But it probably doesn't even have an atmosphere because it's probably stripped away because the sun's very, very active. That's kind of a bummer. But still, who knows what might be there. So that's kind of it. You know, you're kind of caught up to the news as it was before these news items came out that I'm going to mention here. So it looks like they may have found another planet orbiting Proxima Centauri. They're calling this one, what do you think?
SETI Alpha 5.
SETI Alpha. There is no SETI Alpha 5. This is Proxima C. This is the C planet. So it looks to have the following attributes. Probably about seven times Earth's mass. That's technically, I think, a super Earth, but it's kind of really more of a mini Neptune. Probably because it's not going to be too rocky. It's probably got, you know, lots of gases. So it's basically, I think, half the size of Neptune. That's probably what it's going to be very similar to. It's got a 5-year orbit. And some scientists are speculating that it could be wrapped in huge auroras because of its magnetic field interacting with the intense flares from Proxima C. So that's cool. And it could even have an intense ring system, but that's all just speculation. Now, how did they find this thing? This was cool. How do you think? What method do you think did they use to detect the exoplanet Proxima C?
Blood doping.
Transit.
Blood
doping.
What?
Yeah. Transit. Yeah, transit would be a possibility, Evan. But unfortunately, the planet does not go in front of the star from our point
angle.
Of view.
Yeah.
Right. So they use the radial velocity method, otherwise known as Doppler spectroscopy, or the wobble method. Well, think of it this way. The planet doesn't strictly orbit the star, right? They both kind of orbit a gravitational center, right? The gravitational center point is called the barycenter. So the barycenter is often found beneath the surface of the star, right? Because the star is just so much more massive than the planet. But it's still orbiting around that point, even though it's beneath its surface. So then the star is going to be wobbling, and half the time it's going to be kind of wobbling away from us, and the other half it's going to be wobbling towards us. So kind of like a train whistle, right? A train whistle can rise as it approaches you and lowering in pitch as it passes. The frequency of the starlight does a similar thing. It's shifted from more red to more blue.
Ooh, and Doppler shift.
Yeah, so you could see that pattern. And when the pattern repeats, and you could figure out what its orbit is, and from the amplitude, you could kind of figure out how strong the gravitational pull is as well. So you can learn a lot. I mean, there's so much information packed into light; it is incredible. Now, Proxima C looks to be much farther away than B. Proxima B, I think they're thinking that's about 140 million miles away, which is a lot farther than the Proxima B planet. But that means that the unfortunate thing about that is that it's very hard to actually do this analysis. You just can't, you know, turn on your detectors and figure out that there's a planet there in a week or a month or even a year. They've been studying this for a couple of decades almost. For many, many years, they've been looking at this. And the signal is so subtle that only after that much time were they confident enough to really start, you know, publishing and trying to get it out there and peer reviewed. And keep in mind that these observations and analyses have not yet been published or peer reviewed. So it could be a mirage. These signals are so subtle, but they have been working on them for a lot of years, and they've recently, since the first announcement last April, they've been beefing up their analysis and their data, and they're even more confident now. So it looks, you know, pretty good. But we'll have to see what happens. Now, what are the benefits? Big deal. There's a big planet that's only 4.2 light years away. All right, it's the closest exoplanet that probably will ever exist in terms of proximity to Earth. That's awesome. Just in and of itself.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I love the idea.
I love the idea that there's a planet that close to us. I mean, that is reachable.
Oh.
What do you mean by reachable?
I mean, it's, you know, like
with light communication, yes.
With future technology, we would be able to send people there in a lifetime.
Well, lifetime? I don't know. Well, I mean, you're right in that we could theoretically get a ship there with like rocket technology. You don't need warp drive.
But how long would it take?
Rockets. It would take a long time.
Screw rockets, man. You don't want to go there with rockets. We will get there.
Light sails.
Like fusion reactors or something.
Right. Oh, something. Yeah, something crazy like that. We need before anybody would even attempt to do that. I mean, you probably.
But I mean propulsion. You can get there with propulsion. You don't need some. You don't need fancy schmancy warp drive.
Right. But before that, I think we'll see. Evan, you're right. Using light sails and like nanosats and super powerful lasers, we could get a probe there. A tiny probe, but a probe in 20 years.
20
guys,
years, yeah. 20% the speed of light. Right.
That's incredible. Now, of course, it's not going to slow down and go into orbit. It'll be like, hi, bye, you know, kind of thing, where it goes right by the planet. But it could still learn something. Let's see. What else? So, if this planet exists out there, that's great, because that could potentially increase the habitability of the planets that are closer in. You know, be that as may, who knows if it's really even habitable at all. But we think that Jupiter and Saturn protected Earth in the early days of the solar system. So in the same way, this planet could protect Proxima b from things like comets and you know, kind of preserve that planet. We also, this is very important, because most of the stars that you're not seeing are red dwarfs. There's a lot of red dwarfs. In the Milky Way, it's more red dwarfs than pretty much anything in terms of stars. So it's very common. So the more we can learn about how planets might form around a red dwarf, the better we'll be in determining, you know, what kind of life might exist in our galaxy.
Now, Bob, is it true, though, that we have to worry about aliens on this planet?
With funny hair?
I mean, think about it. They're there, man. There could be aliens on that planet, and they could want our hot sauces.
Is that a Rick and Morty reference?
That's a good guess, Garrett.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I'm not even going to answer that, Jay. So the other cool thing is, guys, this is the closest exoplanet. This could be – Proxima C could be the best candidate we ever have, ever, for – direct imaging. We will probably be able to directly image this planet.
Oh my God, that is remarkable. I mean, could you imagine if it has coastlines, if it has mountains,
well,
an ocean?
I mean,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, at half Neptune size, probably not. Now, remember, now we won't be able to probably image directly Proxima b because it's just too close to the parent star. We'll never be able to block out the star well enough and still see Proxima b. But C is far enough away. It's roughly, I think, the distance that Mars is from the sun. We will be able to that's far enough away where we will be able to directly image Proxima C. And we could probably do it with James Webb. Hello, James Webb is going out like this
awesome.
Decade. And then in the future.
Finally.
Yeah, right. And then in the future, we got 30-meter class telescopes like GMTO and ELT. They're going up too. They should be able to directly image this planet. So that might be the best news about Proxima C, is that this will be a planet, that an exoplanet that we could image in the near future, and it will probably be the best image directly of a planet that we will ever see.
I want Google right. Proxima C, right? Like Google Mars or right. Google Moon or what? Google Proxima C. That's what I want.
So all that said, almost done. But the thing that was annoying me is that I did not know that Alpha Centauri is no longer officially Alpha Centauri. They changed the damn name. This is the International Astronomical Union changed the name, and now it's technically or officially Rigel Centaurus. I don't mind that. Triple star says,
Rigel, why? That's confusing.
I know, right. It's like...
Well, Rigel Cantoris was its traditional name.
Right, and that's the only reason why I have a little bit... I'm not like crying right now. Like, all right, it was the original name in Arabic, and it means foot of the centaur. So
why was it changed the first time?
Oh, I don't know. I think somebody came up with that.
Because a European discovered it and named it off a centauri.
Yeah, and I think he did it like centuries
Johann
ago.
Baer in 1603.
Right, it was the 1600s.
Oh, 1603?
All right, well, if Alpha Centauri is available now, I call dibs, man. I'll take that name.
It's still the common name of the star.
Right, a lot of stars have lots of different names. So you may see, if you're reading about it, you may see Rigel Cantaurus, aka Alpha Centauri. You may be seeing that, but it's still like, I mean, this is a special star system. I mean, it's like our neighbor, like Canada. It's like, oh no, we're not Canada anymore. Now we're Kinadu. No. Now we're Kinadu. Like, wait a second. You're our neighbors. What the hell? You just can't change your name. It kind of annoyed me when they changed it.
I still say KT boundary, Garrett. What am I supposed to be saying? Right.
KPG, yeah, officially. KT's fine.
Yeah. Thank you. KT's okay, fine. Thank you. Woo.
So, shoot. Yeah, and Alpha Centauri is still fine, so don't worry. You don't have to say Rigel Cantaurus, but you can if you want to be a stickler. Either are fine. It's just kind of like an annoying thing for our near and dear neighbor, Alpha Centauri.
Yeah. It is like KPG, or so you have to say it's non-avian dinosaurs when you want to refer to dinosaurs that aren't birds.
Somebody will call you on it.
Yeah, we should just specify that now.
Bob, how much do you know about Beta Centauri? We saw both when we were in the Southern Hemisphere. They were
I know.
Naked
I,
eye
awesome.
I know, Beta Centauri. I know everything good. About it.
Yeah.
But I won't
it's
tell
also a triple star system.
Yeah.
And it's 390 light years away.
Wait, what is Beta is?
Beta, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Left farther, but it looks pretty much just as bright as Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, if you go in the Southern Hemisphere, check Alpha and Beta out. They are awesome. They're beautiful. It's so cool.
Does it look as bright because there's actually three of them and not one?
That makes them a little brighter.
Yeah, it makes them a little brighter. I mean, Proxima Centauri doesn't really add much because it's such a dim mother. But the other ones are, it's like two suns. It's like basically taking two suns and putting them at 4.3 light years away. That's what you would see. They're beautiful. And when you look at them, because it was especially interesting for me to see them because I've heard about them and read about them for so long, and to actually have naked eye visibility to that star system was really special. It's like, oh my God, that's the closest stars to us. There it is, and it was bright. It was
you
bright.
You saw them. It was. It was awesome.
Okay, thanks, Bob. All right, so Garrett, you're going to tell us about a recent finding of another feathered dinosaur that has some interesting implications for our understanding of this clade.
Yeah, so it's a new Microraptor relative. I think you guys have talked about Microraptor before. It's the weird four-winged dinosaur. It's got feathers on the legs. We figured out it was black a while back based on melanosomes that are preserved with it because they come from this part of China and northeast China where they're just amazing fossils on the order of the famous Archaeopteryx lithographica sort of beautiful specimens. And so on those, you can see oftentimes a lot of feathers preserved all over the body. And this new one named Wulong is no exception. It is beautiful. It's from the early Cretaceous about 120 million years ago. I was actually thinking when I saw you guys were going to be talking about space objects, I was like, if you were looking at Earth, how far away would you have to be to see this dinosaur right now? But I'm not smart enough to figure it out. Really far. 120 million light years, about.
Give or take.
So, yeah. The full name is Wulong bohiensis, and Wulong means dancing dragon. It's kind of fun because a lot of Chinese dinosaurs just get names based on where they're found, but they gave this one a little bit more fun of a name. And they said it's because it has this sprightly pose, and they think it was nimble. It was pretty cool. Bohiensis, though, is just after the Bohai Strait, which is near the museum where it's housed. But importantly, it's a dromaeosaur, or a raptor dinosaur, which means it has those cool curved claws. Microraptor obviously does, too. And it also has these feathers all over its entire body. So it is just an amazing animal. It's also preserved in basically a single slab of rock and pretty much fully articulated. So we have almost the entire animal just in one. Yeah, it's beautiful. It was about a foot tall and about 3 feet long. Without the tail, it's only about 1 foot long, though. So like 2/3 of it is tail. And a decent chunk of that tail, about 6 inches of it, is just feathers that stick off the end of it. Mm-hmm. The pair of feathers actually remind me a lot of the resplendent quetzal. Do you know that one, Steve?
No.
It's this, I think it's in Mexico because that's where Quetzalcoatlus is, this big pterosaur.
Oh, Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, so I think they're named based on something similar, if not the same thing. The quetzal is this green bird, and it's got these two really long green feathers that come off its tail, and it's really beautiful. This one was probably black, we think. The paleo art of it that's come out already has it as black, because Microraptor, we think, was black. It would have had a wingspan of about 1.5 feet, which is pretty weird proportions for a bird-like animal. So it was like twice as long as it was wide. It also has a really long head. Its skull is longer than its femur.
Is this an adult species they found?
Well, that's the key.
Very good question. Yeah, so in order to figure out if it was an adult, they sliced open its bones in a process called histology. So that you take this little thin section, you put it in a microscope, and then you can examine it really closely. And they look for these things called lines of arrested growth, or lags, which look just like tree rings. And of the bones they tested, only the fibula had maybe one. The others didn't have any. So we think it was probably right around a year old, or maybe under a year old. So not an adult.
How long a lifespan would this dinosaur have had?
So that's one of the big questions, because this group of dinosaurs, in order to test, you have to slice open the bones. And on top of that, most of the bones tend to be crushed, just like with Archaeopteryx. They're like smashed into a single plane. So even when you do cut them, it's kind of hard to see these details that you want to see in 3D. But the oldest one that they reference in the paper was about 4 years old. So these weren't, like a lot of dinosaurs in general, actually. A lot of the ones we find fossilized are maybe teenager equivalents, not really getting to long-lived animals here.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the you said the oldest one that they reference in the paper, is that the oldest of this species, or is this a type specimen? Like, there's only one of them.
Yeah, so this is the type specimen. Okay. There's only one Wulong, but that was another. I think it was a Microraptorine, so it's just like a closely related genus.
Yeah, gotcha. So in terms of like lifespan, in terms of how large this specific species would have gotten, blah, 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 there's just no way to know. They only have one line of evidence right now.
Yeah, that's a huge problem with paleontology in general, because a lot of times you just have the one individual and then people make comparisons and they're like, this one has a bigger head. And you're like, but we only have one of each. If you compare like one human to one chimpanzee, you get all sorts of weird results.
So what's the plan of attack to find more of them? I mean, what's the usual progression now? Like, where do they go from here to try to find more of them?
So a lot of times, like if a scientist found this, what you'd do is you would know the quarry where it came from, and you would go back and you just keep looking around in the same area. But they didn't say where exactly this came from, and I don't think they know they got it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly. They got it, I think, from a collector. I don't even think they mentioned anywhere in the paper, and they were concerned about its provenance because they did a bunch of x-rays and UV light techniques to try to test if it was fake, because there are a lot of fake fossils in China. And they think it's all genuine, except for there was one spot where they could tell these toes got glued on, but they think they're similar enough. It probably just got glued from the other side of the lithograph plate, basically, got stuck to a different piece of rock. But yeah, so I don't think they know where it came from. So it's going to be hard to find more. And even if they did know, honestly, a lot of times we don't find a whole bunch of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like people aren't out there looking already.
Exactly, yeah, because they're really valuable and they're really cool.
Sure.
But there are some dinosaurs in China that we have like 20, 30 of from this area. So there's a decent chance we will find more of them.
Yeah, this whole deposit is very prolific. It's like an early Cretaceous deposit, right?
Yeah, so it's from I think it's Aptian, 120.
We got to look at my chart.
He has a chart. I love that.
Behind him on the wall.
Yeah. That's exactly where it is. I think it technically makes it early Cretaceous because the dividing line's about 100 million years.
Yeah.
But it's in there.
Pretty, the artist's conception, at least, is a very, very pretty animal. I mean, very
it's
interesting
cool.
looking.
Yeah.
With the feathers coming off of its legs. Yeah, so it's got these sort of four wings. Very interesting.
Yeah. I gotta ask you guys to guess what else they found with it. So the hints are they found these little white objects. They're straight, and they looked like they contained some bone in them.
Straight white objects that contain bone. Like gizzard stones?
Eggs?
You're on the right track.
Huh.
Eggs?
Like eggs. Fish yeah. bones?
Was it eating? Like,
so they think it's a coprolite.
Oh, cool.
Oh, it's crap. Awesome. Fossilized crap. Yeah.
Oh, sure. It's crap everywhere.
Apparently the fact that it's straight is important because if it was coiled, it wouldn't have been from a tetrapod.
Okay. Wow.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
So it could be its own poop or it could be something else's poop, but they don't know yet.
Yeah, I wonder at what point did they stop fully pooping? Like, we always envision, I guess, everything we know about dinosaurs we know from Jurassic Park. And so we envision these like large quadrupeds, right? And their pile of poop, like the what was it, a triceratops that was laying on its side, remember? And they were investigating its poop. Mm-hmm. And when we think about coprolites, we think of like turds. But when we think of birds, they have like that poop pee mix, that just like liquidy nonsense. And like, I wonder at what point did bird-like dinosaurs start
Paravians, they're called paravians.
Yeah, paravians. When did they start doing the liquid yumminess?
That's a really good question. Yeah. That's one of those that'd be really hard to nail down too, because how well would that liquid goo fossilize?
Exactly.
So and, finding
yeah,
the
no
positive
car
proof.
Windshields around then.
Yeah, that's true. We need a crapologist to tell us.
No, we need a TARDIS. That's what we need.
A TARDIS.
Oh. That's almost sacrilege, Kara.
I know, I'm sorry. Channeling Evan.
You're just bummed you didn't think of it yourself, yeah. Steve.
I know.
Well done.
All right. So, guys, they discovered a cure for cancer.
Come on.
Again?
Finally.
Which one? Which of the cancers?
Yawn.
All of them.
Is this the B17 infusions in Mexico? I'm going.
Turmeric. Oh. I bet you it's turmeric.
No, so this is a serious news item that is not a cure for all cancer. But the headlines, even the responsible headlines, well, here's one from, I think this was the BBC. Immune discovery, quote, may treat all cancer, end quote.
Mm.
So, yeah, this is a basic science discovery, which who knows if and how long it would take to translate into any actual clinical treatment. But it's a pretty exciting finding, and it has potential. You know, potential is always good. Again, these are the kind of things we talk about, and then 10 years from now, 15 years from now, something actually happens, maybe longer. But who knows? This might be quicker. So let me give you the background. And just this also puts it in perspective. I started hearing about this when I was in medical school in the 1990s, right?
Hear about what?
Immune therapy for cancer. You take a patient's own T cells, you tweak them in some way, and then you infuse them back into the patient, and those tweaked or genetically modified or enhanced T cells then fight the patient's cancer, right?
Mm, makes sense, because then it's customized. Yeah.
So that idea, because it's their own T cells, so there's no rejection, and then they just have some kind of specificity for whatever the cancer is that you're fighting. I remember hearing about this again. Maybe it's probably a 20-year gap at least between when I heard about this and when it was actually being in widespread use. So that'll give you some idea what we're talking about now. But this is the treatment. This is a potential effect on this treatment. So there are multiple immunotherapies for cancer out there now, but this is a specific one called CAR-T. You guys ever heard about that? CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptors.
Chimeric, nice. Okay.
Chimeric. Not a hybrid, but a chimera, right? Chimeric antigen receptors. So for that, you take the T cells and then you use a virus to insert a gene that expresses a receptor that would bind to a specific type of cancer. Ones that are being currently used is the CD19 receptor, which is used to target leukemia and lymphoma. And those are the two cancers where this therapy is most effective, leukemia and lymphoma. It's extremely effective.
That's good. Those are really common cancers too.
Yeah. CAR-T immunotherapy for leukemia and lymphoma. It's less effective against solid tumors, and they're still trying to figure out why that is, whether it's a metabolic difference, you know, anatomical difference in solid tumor cancer cells, or if it's just that it's hard for the immunotherapy to get access to the solid tumors, as opposed to a blood-borne tumor where you just got to put it in the blood and there they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're still sorting that out, and the hope is that CAR-T therapy will have versions of it that are effective against more and more different kinds of cancer as the years go by, right? But here comes the new research then, to do a genome-wide assessment, right? Looking for all kinds of different proteins. And they found one called MR1 receptor that had affinity for every cancer type they tested.
Wow.
They tested it on lung, skin, blood, colon, breast, bone, prostate, ovarian, kidney, and cervical cancer cells. That's a pretty wide range of different kinds of cancer cells. And it had affinity for all of them. So the thinking is at this point, again, this is early days, one study, very exciting. But at this point, the thinking is that there's something metabolic that pretty much every cancer has in common that this receptor has affinity for.
Wow.
Is that like has to do with its uncontrolled growth?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. If you're a cancer cell, by definition, you have this receptor because that's directly related to the out of control high metabolic growth of cancer cells. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, see the CD19 receptor is specific for leukemia and lymphoma, but the MR1 receptor could be cancer specific to every cancer type. And mm-hmm. so if that's true, they could theoretically make CAR T therapy targeting the MR1 receptor, and that could have affinity towards any cancer type.
Wow.
So again, this is just basic science research at this point. First they're going to need to do a whole bunch of follow-up studies to understand it better, then start looking at animal research, and then obviously human research in every different type of cancer, So yeah. If all goes well, just the, just logistically, the doing all of that's going to take years. Like, it's hard to say exactly how many, maybe again, because we're already kind of halfway there because we already have CAR T therapy, may not take as long. Well, here's the other thing that this research involved CRISPR. They did genome-wide CRISPR-Cas9 screening in order to find this protein, the MR1.
Oh, cool. It's an interesting use of the technology.
Yeah. So in the popular write-ups, they didn't even mention it. I only read that in the original study when I went back to the original study. And it's in the headline, genome-wide CRISPR-Cas9. Like, oh, I didn't read that in the press release.
Oh, how funny. And I guess there would be fewer ethical concerns about using it as a screening technique.
It was just for research. So that's the thing. Yeah. So we talk about the clinical applications of CRISPR, but the real benefit of CRISPR is that it supercharges genetic research. And this is an example of that. This study could have taken years, to do previously. This is, this is a tangible benefit of CRISPR-Cas9 technology, again,
yet
indirectly,
another.
because it's advancing research, genetics research is progressing more quickly.
So does somebody own this research, or is it now a free-for-all where everyone can go for it?
That's for the courts to decide. it's actually a matter of lawsuits are involved with who actually owns the patent on CRISPR.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a bummer.
But in the meantime, it's a free-for-all.
Guys, Wild West, go for it.
Well, it's licensed. But all right, Evan, I find the marshmallow test endlessly fascinating, and it's in the news again.
Yes, it is. Hey, Garrett.
Yes.
Good, you're still there. Garrett.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about 5-year-old Garrett. What was 5-year-old Garrett doing to the best of your recollection?
I think he was annoying everyone around him with facts, sometimes made up.
I love that part of it.
But then sometimes not made up.
Sometimes not.
So picture, if you will, 5-year-old Garrett. Okay. You can play the role of 5-year-old Garrett. In a room in which someone comes in and has on a plate your favorite treat. What was your favorite treat to eat at 5 years old?
I don't know. Candy?
Sure. Nice piece of candy, whatever that candy is. It's on the plate, one piece of candy for you. And they say to you, now, Garrett, I'm going to put this down in front of you, and you can have this whenever you like. Okay? However, if you can wait until I come back, I'm going to leave the room. If you can wait until I come back, I'm going to give you another piece of candy. Do you think you can wait, 5-year-old Garrett?
I think I have to say yes, because it's linked to better outcomes in later life.
You didn't know that at 5 years old, Garrett.
All right, seriously, what would 5-year-old Garrett have done? Do you think 5-year-old Garrett would have eaten that candy before the person came back with the second piece?
I think I could have, but I have a hindsight bias knowing how it goes.
Well, what we've just described there is the marshmallow test. Walter Michel, who designed the famous marshmallow test. We've talked about him and the test before.
Yeah.
In which the trying to figure out why what these kids were capable of, if they were able to curb their behavior.
Delayed something, Evan? What is it? Delayed gratification?
Gratification.
Or something?
Yep, that's right. He was initially interested in the various cognitive styles that the children would use to delay that gratification and which styles were really more successful. And he found out that the children who were able to distract themselves by thinking of something else or engaging in an activity were able to delay the gratification longer. And what had been concluded from those studies is that some children had better strategies. They were better able to control their immediate impulses for a longer-term reward. But the study did not really demonstrate whether these skills were learned or innate. But there have been follow-up tests, of course, done since then, and we've spoken about several of them on the show. And it sort of led into a whole branch of marshmallow tests that derived from this.
Yeah, and in this case, I think really they were also – the theoretical basis became so strong around it that it became actually a like almost like a construct in psychology. This delayed gratification idea, the marshmallow test idea, has its own full literature and its own like chapters and textbooks.
Yeah, but the interesting thing was that, you know, when we talked recently about the fact that some more recent replications correlated it better with the, you know, socioeconomic status and other factors, and they showed that the children who came from a more stable environment where they would have learned to trust adults were able to delay gratification. Those kids from an environment where they wouldn't really have learned to trust adults went right for the marshmallow. It had nothing. It may not have anything to do with self control, but they're like, well, that guy's not coming back with a marshmallow. I'm going to take this, you know.
So and kids who are from like food unstable households, like there's just so many things that feed into that difference. Like, of course, if you're rich, white, you know that you're going to get fed 3 square meals a day, and you trust that the grown up is going to come right back. You're going to be in a better position there.
Well, perhaps that's one of the interesting things about this new test, which is the new news item. And thanks to our good friend Jennifer Willette, she brought this news item to our attention by writing an article about it in Ars Technica. She's awesome. So she, it's a new take on the marshmallow test. The findings appeared in the journal Psychological Science. And the researchers from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology said their experiments are the first to show that children are more willing to delay gratification for cooperative reasons than for individual goals.
Mm. Oh, cool. And
by this, so they designed a slightly different version of the marshmallow test that we just described. So here were the parameters. 200 subjects, all of them 5- and 6-year-old children, from 2 distinct cultures. One set of children tested in Germany, in a laboratory, and another set of children tested in Kenya at local schools, the Kikuyu tribe in Kenya. Prior to the experiments, each of those children had played a collaborative game of balloon toss as a warm-up exercise, and they did 3 experimental setups, so I'll describe the 3 conditions. The first was the solo condition. 2 children were each given a cookie. They were told that they could wait to eat it. If they were able to wait to eat it, they would receive another cookie. So that's, and by the way, the 2 kids were in separate rooms from each other. So they were not situated together, each child in its own room. Now that's the classic marshmallow test that we just described. Straightforward. One child does not affect the other. The second condition is called the interdependence condition. Both children were given cookies and told that if they both successfully waited to eat it, both of them would get a second cookie. But if one child couldn't delay his or her gratification, then neither child would receive the second cookie. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the interdependence.
Like the prisoner dilemma?
It's like a really happy version of the prisoner dilemma.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The last condition is the dependence condition. So both children given a cookie, each child was told that if they could refrain from eating it, they and their partner would get a second cookie. But in this condition, this dependence condition, one child thought the partner depended on them, but they did not depend on their partner. See the difference there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here's what they said. So I quote from co-author Rebecca Kuman, "Children may have been motivated to delay gratification because they felt they shouldn't let their partner down." This is the interdependence condition she's talking about. "And if they did, their partner would have had the right to hold them accountable." The fact that we obtained these so basically what happened here is that they had the children who were part of the interdependence condition were able to stem off their wanting for eating that cookie better or more effectively than the other two conditions, the dependence condition and the solo condition. Mm. And the facts that they couldn't see or communicate with the other, you know, counterpart for the one for the other child attests to the strong motivational consequences that simply being in a cooperative context has for children from early on in development. So basically it's instilled early, I suppose.
That's really cool. You know, I can imagine there's multiple reasons why they'd want to run a test like that. But, I mean, it shows you that we're social creatures and that we are programmed to deal with social structures like that or social, you know, environments where other people are around.
But it is interesting to think, how old were these kids?
5 and 6 years old.
Yeah, it's actually kind of surprising, those results, to me a little bit, because you're right, Jay, like from an evolutionary perspective, obviously we are very social creatures, but also, but 5 and 6 is a little bit older, but at 2 or 3, I would be very surprised to see those results, because kids just, like, they don't really even have theory of mind.
I don't even know
they're just starting to develop it.
Yeah, it's more of a hypothesis back then.
Yeah, they're just assholes. Like, they're just like, everything is for me.
Going through
the
motions, right? I mean, yeah, right. How can a 2 or 3 year old really understand that another child and what their action is doing may have an impact on your action? But maybe
they're starting to develop those skills.
At 5 or 6 years old, yes, you can see how they mm-hmm. would have be able to at least understand that.
So you mentioned that there was a fear that the other person might punish them, basically. Was there actually any mechanism for that in the study, or was it just that they assume that the kids are worried about it?
Not that I saw. There could have been in there, but I read. I did not see that they felt that any other sort of punishment would be a result of the behavior being influenced.
Other than just shaming.
Right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, hey, you know that someone, you're 5 or 6 years old, you know someone, your actions are going to be responsible for what happens for the other child as well, but yet you both benefit if you can both stick to the plan, and there you go. There's your motivation.
But shame is powerful.
To get through this. Yeah.
Yeah, shame's great.
Yeah. Yeah. More shame. So really more interesting. Shame. Plus, I like the fact that they did this both in Kenya and in Germany, two very distinct cultures, and came up with similar results.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right, Kara, does stress actually make you gray?
Well, that's really the question, right? And I'd love to survey everybody here, other than Steve, who I know has read this study. Do you guys think, we've all heard this, right? Like, stress makes you go gray, stress makes you gray prematurely or more quickly. Do mm-hmm. you guys think that there is actually a link, or is that folklore?
It's almost like an urban legend. I mean, I've heard people, I've read stories, I guess, where people have said that their hair turned white after, you know, a scary situation. And I can't imagine that can happen, because I know physiologically that the hair that grows white is different than, you know, the hair that grows with color. And it's not something that can, like, happen to existing hair.
Right. What would be the mechanism to force it?
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. I would think no. I think that. I would think that stress wouldn't make your hair turn white.
So what if I told you that, and what I love about this study is that it's one of those beautiful examples of the scientific method in action, right? That there's anecdotal evidence that people have reported that, you know, after stressful situations, their hair grayed more quickly. And so these researchers said, let's look into this and see if this is actually true. And what if I told you that they did discover that there is a mechanism there? What mechanism do you think would be at play?
Yeah, what mechanism would it be?
Well, it's, I think our hair turns color the same way that, like, dinosaurs do. Sorry, all of my knowledge is dinosaurs. But we have the melanosomes, right? And they add the pigment.
So that's how your hair is colored. So black, brown, red, blonde, whatever. And white hair is when that pigment's no longer there, right?
Yeah, so it's got to be something that's killing off the melanosome functionality.
Yeah, and so the researchers...
Your body turns against the pigment? And just kind of
that,
like,
right there was absolutely the first thought that the researchers said, right? Maybe there's, like, an immune response, like, or there's, like, a cortisol response. So I'm stressed, I produce a lot of this hormone cortisol, and I have some sort of immune reaction towards these melanocytes,
right?
And that's what's causing the hair to go gray. But then they found that, nope, that's not the case. Even in mouse models where they had no cortisol response, the hair was still turning gray. or where they knocked out the immune system, the hair was still turning gray. So then they were like, what could possibly be happening? And it's actually almost like more straightforward, or at least I think a little bit easier to understand, but quite surprising. So you guys remember all of the divisions of the nervous system, right?
Oh, all of them.
Absolutely.
So when we think about the nervous system, we think of like the central and the peripheral nervous system. You guys remember that division?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those two.
Brain and spinal cord.
There's a sympathetic system as
well. There you go. Okay, yeah. So when we talk about the peripheral nervous system, we talk about the somatic and the autonomic nervous system. You guys remember? So somatic would be the things that we have control over. Autonomic would be the things that we don't. And then beyond that, we can further subdivide into the sympathetic and the parasympathetic.
Yes.
Okay. So sympathetic is fight or flight. Mm-hmm. Or what do they say? Fight, flight, or what's the other one now? Steve, have you ever heard that where they add a third F to it?
Really?
Freeze. So it's fight, flight, or freeze.
And then the parasympathetic is the kind of after the sympathetic response, so the relaxing response. And all sorts of different things happen in the body during this parasympathetic response. Some people call it like the rest and digest response or the feed and breathe response. So it's kind of considered to be the alternative, or the not so much the opposite, but that's how we sort of conceptualize it. So these are functional distinctions. And what these researchers found, which is really interesting, is that when your sympathetic nerves are activated, so remember, these are the fight or flight nerves that, of course, are going to be activated during stress cues, that they actually deplete the stem cells that would become melanocytes.
What?
Huh.
Yeah.
Deplete
so
the
here's
stem
how
cells.
This works. What's a depleted stem cell?
Yeah. So here's how this works. It's really interesting. Your sympathetic nerves actually, they don't so much terminate, but they sort of wrap around all the way up to your skin, right? They're going to go everywhere in your body, and they're going to eventually end kind of up in your skin. And in some ways, they're wrapped around these different little areas under the skin. And we think of let's back it up. Hair grows out of hair follicles. Yes, we know this. Mm-hmm. There are about, I found this statistic and I thought it was pretty interesting. There are about 100,000 hair follicles on your scalp. And inside of those hair follicles, there's a whole lot of cool stuff happening. There are melanocytes, and there are melanocyte stem cells. So these stem cells are the precursors to become melanocytes. And you only have so many of them. And they exist in what they call like a melanocyte stem cell niche. We're going to get so much hate for this. I pronounce it niche. I know you guys pronounce it niche. Do you say niche, Evan?
Sometimes.
I never say niche.
I never say niche, but like so many people listening say niche. So sorry, I'm going niche. I also go GIF. Deal with it.
I say WAV now instead of WAVE, thanks to Richard Wiseman.
Exactly.
If it's good enough for Wiseman, it's good enough for me.
So within these 100,000 hair follicles, you have a lot of stuff going on, obviously. But one of the things that's going on in there structurally are these melanocyte stem cell niches. And that's sort of like the microenvironment of where the melanocyte stem cells live. And actually, the sympathetic nerves, they sort of terminate near where those melanocyte stem cells are. So they're running right by them. And when there is a really intense stress response, and they are really, really active and firing a lot, what you actually find is they activate the melanocyte stem cells to start producing melanocytes. And they start producing in a large quantity. It's not a measured response. It's like an intense reaction response. And they physically become depleted. They regenerate so quickly and they produce so quickly that after they've been exposed to this this norepinephrine, this noradrenaline from the sympathetic nerves, they activate, they convert, and then they're done.
It burns
them
out.
It gets rid of them. It burns them out. And so you can actually burn out the stem cells that will produce the pigment-producing cells from your hair follicles due to stress. And the one major question that's kind of hanging over their heads are, is this the same response that occurs in aging? And is it as simple as we're just accelerating the graying that happens with aging due to intense life stress? Or is it a completely different mechanism? They still don't know. But they do know that you will go gray, or not, I shouldn't say you will, but there are cases in which people go gray more quickly, or they develop more gray hairs Or there are some of these really extreme examples where people will get like a patch of gray, or they'll like actually have a pretty significant change due to stressors in their life. But of course, all this research was done in mice, but they were very good mouse models. And there's no reason to believe that there's a big difference between human hair follicles and human melanocyte models and mouse ones.
But there could
totally
be.
Interesting.
It's not implausible.
There could be, yeah.
But the next step is stress out some monkeys.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And then eventually just kind of, you know, people are stressed anyways.
But the idea that your hair would go gray from seeing, or you, if you thought you saw a ghost, you know, like that's like the urban legend type of thing.
Sure, and the thing is, there may be, this provides a mechanism by which it could be at least somewhat explainable. It doesn't mean that that happens. It doesn't mean it happens all the time. But there, you know, I think a lot of these articles open with the idea that Marie Antoinette, when she found out she was going to go onto the guillotine, like she went gray overnight or something like that. It's not, you're right, Jay. It's not the physical hair that was already brown that turned gray.
It doesn't drain the color out of your hair.
No. But the new hair growth could be gray. So after a very, very stressful event, the new growth could start coming out gray. I don't know how likely it is that it would happen all over your head, but I would guess that if it were a very, very, very stressful event and you had like an incredibly extreme sympathetic response, there could be something that was significant enough that you could see it. Yeah, there's no, I mean, there, at least we know now that there is kind of a mechanism for it. And I guess how that plays out in real life is yet to be seen.
Yeah.
I want to know how do they stress the mice out? You know, like were they like yelling at them, "You're fired."
They put a cat outside the cage.
"You have a lot of debt." You know, they just start screaming shit like that at them.
Okay. Restraint and chronic unpredictable stress procedures were performed as previously described. So they did restraint stress, right? So they kept the mice in a restraining device for 4 hours a day, so they weren't able to like get loose, and that was super stressful for them.
That sucks.
And then the other stressors were cage tilt, isolation, damp bedding, rapid light and dark changes, overnight illumination, empty cage, and changing the cage 3 times. So they varied the type of stress, and they kind of came at it from a bunch of different angles. And of course, did those all as separate treatment states.
If it's as simple as just stress, do you think you could just look at maybe like twins or siblings and see if the one that has a high stress job might have gray hair over the guy living on the beach?
I mean, you could, but it's one of those hard things, right? Like when we look at twin studies, the earlier, the younger they are, the more you're going to be able to see purely genetic differences versus environmental changes. But by the time we're talking about, you know, a high stress job or the guy hanging on the beach, they're adults. And so it's going to be really hard to understand what are all the other environmental factors that could have fed into graying. I mean, maybe if you had a large enough sample of identical twins where one twin had like a really chill job and had never really had any intense life stressors, and the other one, like, just their life was horrible, you might be able to see those changes. But I would assume that there were so many confounding factors that that would be difficult.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy.
That's my favorite noisy of the year so far, by the way.
Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, that one. This is a good one. I got so many like insane joke responses here.
How could you not?
I tried to give you guys a little mix here. So Natasha Muse totally wins. This is the one that made me laugh out loud. She said, "Hello, Jay, and happy Saturday to you. This week's Who's That Noisy is obviously somebody having a vowel movement. Thanks so much.
Vowel movement. Clever.
That is 2 SGU points for the excellent joke. Patrick Carr wrote in, "Hi, Jay. The noisy today can only be one thing, a male actor soundboard for dubbing porn." There must be. that's all you need to hear about that.
He closes
his email with "Happy Captain Picard Day." Which, was there a Captain Picard Day that I missed?
Or is that, Thursday?
Series. Coming up tomorrow.
That's tomorrow then. Okay, good.
2 days ago.
There was also an episode of Next Gen where it literally was Captain Picard Day, and he had to meet with kids.
Oh, that's right. get trapped in the, right.
I had many people, many, email in and say that they thought that this was Evan. Like, this was snippets of Evan talking.
Yeah, that is something I would do.
And then a lot of people, this one is representative, but Noel Rupenthal wrote in and said someone recording grunts for a video game. Like, they thought it was like canned video game, like noises of combat or something. You know, like, I got a lot of emails about that. That's mm-hmm. not true either. There is a winner, though. Richard Moore wrote in and said, Jay, I'm a longtime listener, but this is the first Noisy I've responded to. This week's Noisy is a series of vowel sound samples from the IPA vowel chart.
IPA.
This is pretty cool. So, of course, that was computer simulated. And the person who originally sent in this Noisy, David Morrison Weigel, said that he said he recently came across this very useful interactive chart of international phonetic alphabet symbols, IPA. The Noisy attaches a recording of him clicking through all vowel sounds on the chart in sequence. In other words, a comprehensive collection of all vowel sounds in all human languages represented by IPA. And he's been listening for 10 years and he thanks us. I was trying to figure out if this was computer generated or not. And I think it may be computer generated. Let me play a little bit of it again for you guys. You could tell me what you think.
They sound recorded to me.
Yeah, but maybe
yeah,
now
I
that
so.
I,
yeah, by a human.
Yeah,
now I think that it's just really compressed.
Mm-hmm.
There was definitely some ones towards the end that had a French sound to them
yeah,
that I thought were,
yeah, I thought
were really
it sounded
cool.
French.
Listen. There you go.
Oh gosh, just insulting our French listening audience. Okay, some Canadians too.
So I had somebody write, and this is Bob. This is for you. I totally did this for you. Somebody wrote in. And they sent me a link to a snippet of a movie. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but they thought that it was from this movie, okay? So this is a brief moment in a movie that some of you might recognize, but it's funny, so listen to this.
Hamburger.
I'm a girl.
Hamburger.
I am a girl.
Hamburger.
I'm a girl.
Ham.
I'm.
Burr.
Bill.
Gurr.
Girl.
I'm back out. Now that's Steve Martin, right?
Yeah, that's Steve yeah. Martin as Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah, I remember
oh
that scene.
Gosh,
it was such a funny
right.
scene, and he's got such a beef. He hates hamburgers because it's like, you know, it's like this lame American food. He's like, oh my god, it's like the height of the disgusting, you know, cuisine. And then he's in New York and he actually eats a hamburger and he has an epiphany with music and the gestures. And he's like, oh my god, it was wonderful.
Right, but Bob,
I love that scene.
Now, I'll let our audience correct me because I'm not going to waste any time doing research on it. This is the exact type of thing I can waste an hour just doing internet research on. But I actually believe this version of it that I played for you is the French version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because when I watched the video, it looked like Steve Martin was being overdubbed. It didn't completely match his mouth.
Yes,
so this is a
not sound like him.
I think it's a French voice actor pretending to be Inspector Clouseau. You know what I mean? Like the whole thing is that he is French, correct?
It's very meta.
Yeah, it's totally meta. But it's 10 times funnier than the original movie when you watch the scene. So anyway, I'll send the link to you guys, but man, that was awesome. So thank you for sending that in. That made my freaking internet week, by the way. I have a new Noisy for all of you. I want a very specific explanation of what this is.
Mm-hmm. Wipe out.
That's awesome, Evan. So if you think you have the answer to this week's Noisy, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
We got some events coming up. February 8th. This is very local. This is in Stamford, Connecticut. I'm going to be doing the Darwin Day dinner in Stamford, 6 p.m. cocktail, 7 p.m. for the talk in Stamford, Connecticut. You could look it up online, darwindayconnecticut.org. I'm giving a talk about evolution, science denial, etc. And then... following that, I will be in Tyler, Texas. Tyler, Texas.
Wow.
I'll be giving two talks there, actually. This is at the University of Texas at Tyler, Texas. But these are open to the public. So one is at the University of Texas. The other one is at Tyler Junior College. This is Wednesday, February 12th.
Darwin's Day.
Yep. I'll be talking about science denial from 6 to 7 p.m. And then on Thursday, February 13th, Countering Creationist Logic, also from 6 to 7. So check that out. Yeah, so I got 3 Darwin Day talks this year.
Nice.
And then after that, that's when we're going to Seattle for the AAAS.
Yeah, and you got a busy week.
For our first Seattle extravaganza.
Yes, but 2 weeks prior to that, Steve, we will be in Pittsburgh, PA, January 31st, doing an extravaganza. Then the very next day, that's February 1st, we have a private show. There are still tickets available for RLDs, by the way. We have a private show during the day. Then that night in Philadelphia, we have an extravaganza. That's February 1st. Then on February 2nd, we'll be in Brooklyn, New York. And yet again, another extravaganza. That's 4 shows in 2.5 days.
Cool.
So if you want any information on any of this, you can go to theskepticsguide.org/events. All of the stuff is there. Please join us. We're going to have a really good time. The private show in Philly is going to be exceptionally good this year.
Why will it be exceptionally good?
Because it'll be smothered in cheese.
If I tell everyone, it'll reveal the awesomeness.
I hope we can deliver on this promise.
Did you clear that with the marketing department, Jay?
No. I mean, I'm trying to sell tickets, Steve, for Christ's sake.
All right, I hear you. Every private show is special.
So you can also, all of this stuff is also on our Facebook page under events, and we will see you. Now, I'm looking forward to doing 3 extravaganzas back to back. We've never done that before.
It's something, all right. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Garrett, are you ready for your first science or fiction?
I think I bat about 1 out of 100 when I listen to the show.
So you're a good company. You play at home, so this is your first time playing with us.
Yeah.
So we'll see how you do. So there's a theme.
Steve, you missed it. Steve, you missed it. Garrett basically said he sucks at science or fiction.
Yeah, I didn't miss anything.
It's a fact.
I don't miss a thing.
Don't tell Steve what he missed. Or didn't miss.
Right, what you missed, Jay, is that there's a theme this week.
Yes.
And that theme is, I do this every year.
Dinosaurs.
The new species that were discovered in 2019.
Oh, crap.
I hope they're all dinosaurs.
Yes. None of them are dinosaurs.
Living species?
Sometimes they're extinct, but these are all living species. Maybe I'll do a separate one.
Living dinosaurs, what?
So 2 of these are real and 1 is fake.
The fake one's the living dinosaur.
Sleestaks are fake.
Flea stacks are fake. Okay.
They can't be. They can talk.
Item number 1. A deep water shark discovered in the Gulf of Mexico, Mollusquama mississippiensis, has light-producing organs and is also the second largest shark known, second only to the whale shark. Item number 2. A new plant with giant leaves over 8 feet long, Coccolobia gigantifolia, was finally described. Researchers had to wait 13 years to grow the plant from seeds until it produced flowers and fruit, allowing for a full description. And item number 3, a new species of grouper, Epinephilus fuscomarginatus, was discovered in a fish market. The scientist had to purchase all the specimens to bring back to his lab.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Oh, man.
All right, Garrett, as our guest, you have the honor of going first.
What an honor it is.
Yes.
So first, I mean, I know that there was a coelacanth described, and we thought that fish was extinct and had no living ancestors. So the ocean is just a disaster of things we don't know. It's just a million things. So that makes me just want to pick the plant being the fiction right away, because the other two are in the ocean, potentially. But the plant, it seems like, how could we find a new plant? I guess somewhere deep in the Amazon, maybe they found a plant, and then I don't know how you name a plant. Do you have to grow it from a seed for it to be official? Could be. I don't know. And the second largest shark known. How could we? It's deep water. I mean, I think I've heard we know more about space than we know about the deepest parts of the ocean. So, sure, there could be something new down there. So I'm going to go with the plant being the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that, but I'm going back and forth between the plant and the shark. I mean, a shark that not only has a light-producing organ, which is epic, but also second largest. I mean, a whale shark is what, 50, 60 feet? Like a bus. They're huge. So this is – but there's white sharks that are like 20, 25. So this has got to be like, say, at least 30 feet long that we've missed, even though it was in the deep water. I mean, this is huge. It's a huge fish.
Well, it's like giant squid, right?
Yeah, that's true. But we've seen them. I've seen specimens of them. No one's even hinted at that, as far as I could tell, about a shark like this. But that's true about the squid. There's a lot that we there's still so mysterious. Yeah, and the plant doesn't sound right. Cocolobia gigantifolia. I mean, that just sounds like a lame name. But I can't go by lame names because we know there's tons of them everywhere. So, but did Steve make that up? Gigantifolia. It sounds like Steve would come up with that. and growing it from seeds. So what? So they had no. So somebody gave him a seed and said, here's a new plant. You don't know what this is. And I can't tell you where I got it from because I'm not going to tell you. So you got to grow it on your own. Yeah, it sounds like baloney. I'll go with the plant.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, for a lot of the same reasons, I think I'm going to go with this plant as well. First of all, gigantifolia. I don't know about that. That seems just a little too convenient almost. And yeah, I mean, these seeds? Like what? Jack and the Beanstalk magic seeds kind of thing? I mean, what, they just some traded a cow for them and figured out? I don't quite understand the backstory to this. So because that's not making a lot of sense to me, this seems to me to be the fiction given the three.
Okay, Kara?
So I think we all agree about the grouper. It's a fun story. It sounds right. So it's between the plant and the shark, man. But I just feel like, you know that kind of concept that I think Bob talks about it a lot in science or fiction? Like, I would have heard about this.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have heard about the plant because it's like a plant. And also this definitely, like, I think it's Bob that said where, like in the Amazon. Yeah. Like there are rainforests all over the world. It doesn't have to be Amazon. It could have been in Indonesia or something. Huge, huge plants. And the idea that they had to grow it from the seed so they could fully describe it is not weird to me. You can do that with plants. Like they could have said, we discovered this, and then they could say, we want to know more to give a full description, so I'm going to grow it. So that seems more realistic than the second largest shark ever known, and I've never heard of this. And it has a light-producing organ, which is like a very deep, that's super deep water. And can things that are that deep be that big? I don't know. Most of the things that are deep enough to have a light-producing organ are small. I don't think sharks can have light-producing organs either.
Yeah, it sounds
can
sketchy.
They? This sounds sketchy to me.
Doomed.
I don't know. I don't like this one. Too many things about it are weird. And I kind of do want it to be true. I think it's the fiction. But if it is true, I'll be like, whoa, that's cool. But also, how did we not talk about this on the show last year?
All right, so you're going with the shark. All right. Yeah. And Jay.
All right. I know why Steve picked me last, guys.
Why?
I'll tell you why. And this will answer all your questions. Because I have kids. And because I have kids, I read a lot of books about sharks. Like, ooh. All the time.
All the time.
So I happen to know the top 10 list of the top 10 biggest sharks.
And this guy ain't on it.
And Mr. Mississippi over here is not on that list.
It was just discovered. You'd have to buy a book written
That's
in the
true.
Last
is
month.
A brand new book? Damn it. Damn it.
Don't talk him out of it.
Wait, you think that the books that I'm buying are, like, published in 2020? Meaning, like, it's been a year, you know what I mean? Like, it's plenty of time. I have, like, 10 shark books in the other room. Like, I read all of them every week.
Finish them? Thanks, Kara. God.
So
that counts.
The first thing that tripped me up was the name, because all I heard was Mexico and then Mississippi, and I'm like, oh, that one's got to be fake. And then I'm like, wait a second.
What do you mean? They're both in the Gulf.
I know, but I was, you know, really quick. My knee-jerk reaction was like, wait a second, it's Mexico and Mississippi is far away. Well, it is far away, but it's in the Gulf.
It's not that far from Mexico.
I said I didn't hear Gulf. I just heard Mexico. So then I'm like, all right, that seems legit. But I agree with Kara about the organs. Totally. You never heard of a shark with glowing organs. Get the hell out of here with that. But this is not on the top 10 list. So I have to say this one is the fake. And I default to not knowing that much about the plants. I mean, I certainly have not heard of Gigantifolia. And the grouper, yeah. I mean, fish, yes. If there's a fish, there's a large size of it and there's a small size of it. So that's like, you know, that's like my instant yes when they say fish and blah. So, yep, this shark, nope. Fiction, baby. Me and Kara went for the win.
All right. The fish one has nothing to do with size, right?
Whatever.
Whatever. I was wondering where that was coming from.
Or the country of Mexico, but okay.
Although it is a big fish, but all right, let's go. We'll start with three then, since you all agree on this one. A new species of grouper, Epinephilus fusco marginatus, was discovered in a fish market. The scientist had to purchase all the specimens to bring back to his lab. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yes.
That's cool. One I wonder how often that's happened in the past. Where like
very often. It's also really? it's not the first species last year of fish that was discovered in the market. There was another one I could have used.
This dramatic scene, it reminds me of The Empire Strikes Back when Chewbacca is grabbing all of C-3PO's parts before they throw him in the furnace. Because the scientist is like, no, don't buy this fish. Don't eat that. Get the hell out of here.
Right.
You know, he's like, he wants all the samples to bring back to the laboratory. There's a little movie right there.
Well, and it also shows you, I think, how biased we are in our language sometimes when we talk about something being discovered as if nobody knew about it before. It's like, no, it was new to science.
Yeah, they always say new to science. Like everyone,
that's how we should be
it's
saying
always
it,
new
right?
to science. Yes.
Yes, because these people were already selling it and people were purchasing it and they were eating it. These fishermen knew about it.
That's right. And so this guy,
exactly.
The scientist, Jeff Johnson, who's an ichthyologist with Australia's Queensland Museum. So he's heard about this mystery grouper for years and occasionally got photographs from people saying, hey, what kind of fish is this? He's like, I don't know, that could be a new fish. Then he got one in 2017. And so he went to, you know, the market where these things were showing up, and he found five of them. He bought them all. It's a big fish. It's like 2-3 feet big. It's a big grouper.
Whoa.
And he said, yeah, that is probably a species new to science. So he did it, did DNA analysis, and indeed it is a new type of grouper. So the reason why this, you know, a couple of reasons why this is so common. One is fishermen don't know what the hell they're catching. We talked about this actually not too long ago. When you buy something on the sea bass or whatever it is on the menu, you're not always getting sea bass. Like a lot
Chilean
of the time.
Sea bass.
Yeah, you're
no,
getting
sea bass
something
isn't even
else.
Real.
You're getting white
this
right
is
fish,
what we talk
yeah.
about.
Yeah, it's not
Chilean
even real.
Sea bass. Do you guys remember what it's actually called?
It's like
called?
A blobfish. It's like all kinds
oh, yeah,
of weird names.
Patagonian toothfish.
I'm yeah, not like, ordering that. Give me the sea bass.
They come up with a culinary name for a group of fish. And then also, they're just not checking that carefully. It's like, yeah, it's a grouper, whatever. And also, as we know, like when you learn about an animal, it's probably a genus and not a species. You know what I mean? Like
that's
everything.
True.
Like elephant is a genus, giraffe is a genus, zebra is a genus. These are not specific species. And there's multiple species within that genus. And so what we're often talking about is that they disambiguated, you know, two different species in the same genus as distinct. They were previously combined into one species. And they're like, oh, this is actually a distinct species. So very, very common, all of that. All right, I guess we'll go to number two, a new plant with giant leaves over 8 feet long, Coccolobia gigantifolia, was finally described. Researchers had to wait 13 years to grow the plant from seeds until it produced flowers and fruit, allowing for a full description. Bob, Evan, and Garrett, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Kara, you think this one is science. And what's interesting is that Bob and Evan agreed with Garrett even after he told them what his record was with science fiction. This one is...
I basically opened a door that said it's definitely fiction.
So wait, Steve, are you
this
saying we can blame Garrett if we're
is,
wrong?
Is science. No, you are responsible for yourself, Evan.
Wait, what? Yeah. I can't blame Garrett for this loss? Oh, fine. Okay.
The leaf is huge. That. It's like 8 feet and wider than a person. Like it's a massive leaf, of course. And it is in the Amazon.
Yay.
A Brazilian Amazon. And... It was actually first identified by botanists, right? Not by natives, by a botanist in 1982, but they weren't able to get a specimen. And then in 2005, it became quote unquote locally famous. So the locals knew about it. So the researchers went there. They couldn't bring a leaf back because it was too big. It was literally too big to bring the leaf back. And the tree that they found had not flowered or fruited. So they brought seeds back and then grew them. And 13 years later, in 2018, they were able to get flower and fruit from a mature tree so they could do enough of a description to gain it a designation as a new species, which was official in 2019.
Is that common that's how you describe a plant?
Yeah, like you can't just describe the leaves. You need to describe the full plant. If it's a fruiting plant, you need to describe the fruit in order, to get a species designation.
But they couldn't transport it, so they had to grow
it. Yeah, right. They had to grow it. And they had to wait for 13 years to name their new species.
So are these leaves, they're 8 feet long, but are they still like leaf shaped?
Yeah.
Are they like 4 feet wide
too?
Yeah,
they're like 6 feet wide. That's crazy. They're massive. They're massive.
Could live under that leaf.
Could. Yeah. Could.
Yeah.
Could use it as a blanket.
Live under that leaf.
Yeah, one leaf as a blanket. Okay. For a queen size bed. All right. Which means that number one, a deep water shark discovered in the Gulf of Mexico, Mollusquama mississippiensis, has light producing organs and is also the second largest shark known, second only to the whale shark, is the fiction, but a lot more of this is science than you might think.
See?
So the only thing that's fiction about this is the size. So this is a pocket shark. It's adorable. It's adorable. It's small. But the name pocket shark does not come from its diminutive size. It comes because it has pocket-like openings or glands found behind each of its pectoral fins.
It's marsupial.
But it also has light-producing organs, photophores.
What? No,
covering
it
much of its body. Yes, light-producing organs or photophores covering much of its body. Now, they haven't seen the thing in... down deep. This thing was pulled up by a fisherman's net. So they only assume that they will light up when it goes down, that they'll glow in the dark because, they can identify what they're like. But they haven't actually seen it to verify it. And it's a cute little guy. It's a cute little shark. So, yeah, I made up the thing about it being huge. And it is Mollusquama mississippiensis. That is the name. And it was discovered in the Gulf of Mexico. But it's tiny.
Coming soon to shark books near you.
Yeah. Exactly.
Near Jay, at least.
Yeah, but I figured, that people would play the second biggest one, and you'd be the dilemma is, but it's down deep. Could there be something that deep, and we didn't discover it? So you guys had the exact discussion.
Yeah, screw you.
Are things that are... Could it have been bigger if it were down deep?
Yeah, so things can be big in down deep, and there's a lot, everything drifts down. There's a lot of nutrition down there.
Falls
absolutely.
Down there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, no question.
I was thinking like hydrothermic vent deep, but I guess I could have not gone that far.
It's deep enough where they have, phosphorescent patches on its body.
Yeah, it's dark. There's no light there.
They were trying to figure out, in fact, what the researchers were looking for were they were trying to figure out what sperm whales eat. And this is one of the things that got dragged up in the collection. Huh.
Jay tried to show me his pocket shark once. I didn't look.
So, Steve, did you think I'd know about this or no?
I don't know.
No.
Wow. I mean, I know that you know,
no
I know that you have
whatsoever.
The kid animal
I just,
thing
I just
going
deflated
on.
Over here. I'm like, oh, wow. I thought Steve had, oh, Jay must know about this.
It's 2019 stuff. It's stuff that's too new for you to hear about unless you heard about it in the news,
Yeah.
But I didn't hear about these things. I figured if I didn't hear about it, possibly you didn't hear about it. All right. Well, Garrett, don't feel bad. Most people lose on their very first time playing science fiction.
I'm used to it.
You mean numb.
But this time you had an audience.
There are witnesses to your failure. All right. Evan, give us a quote.
All right. The quote this week was submitted by a listener, Adam Mullis from Iowa. He's a grad student at Iowa State University. And Bob, he's studying nanoparticles that make antibiotics work more effectively.
Very nice.
I say, go, Adam. Go for it. So thanks for suggesting this one, Adam. Extended training in nonsense doesn't make for better nonsense. Precise and to the point. Mark Krislip wrote that in a science-based medicine article.
Of course.
Nice.
Very cool.
That sounds like everything that we deal with in science-based medicine.
Yeah. I think the first thing that comes to my mind is like naturopathy or like chiropractic.
Yeah.
Like these things where people spend years studying nonsense.
Exactly.
To then go and practice it.
Yep.
Crazy, like, as I said, that's like everything that we deal with.
Sums it up well.
Thanks, Evan. Garrett, thanks for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, Garrett.
Yeah, thank you for having
Garrett.
Me.
Dynamite, Garrett.
So email us when you come up across good dinosaur news. Always looking for good dinosaur.
Oh, sure, yeah.
By the way, this is one of my – I had so many choices for news items this week. The other one that I was thinking of talking about was a new study pretty much confirming that it was an asteroid that killed the non-avian dinosaurs.
That was a big one.
Yeah, not the volcanoes. They kind of peaked way before the extinction event, and so
probably, and not a mix either.
It was probably purely. It was not a mix. Yeah. It was purely the asteroid. I mean, it's one study. It's not. There's still other opinions, but it was a pretty powerful salvo in that debate that I've been following over the last year. Not many people realize it is a debate. They think it's done and done. It was an asteroid, but the volcanic eruptions from the Deccan Traps has been in the mix as to maybe contributing to some extent to the extinction. But this latest study said, nope, it was probably all the asteroid.
Yeah, that's usually what I hear when we're talking to paleontologists, too. Yeah. They tend to ignore the volcanism.
Yeah, yeah. So we're back to what everyone thought it was in the first place.
Just like Brontosaurus.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Full circle.
Forget all that stuff. But it's Rigel Centaurus now, right? Just so something else to be right. Nerdy and pedantic about. You mean Rigel Centaurus?
I mean,
dear skeptics, guys, I'd like to correct you.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Anytime, brother.
Thanks,
Steve. Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.